Does that create a kind of a Chinese sphere of influence? If not politically in an old-fashioned sense of conquering territories, but in a new age sense of controlling what is said within these countries by way of economic influence.
Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Megan Rutkai, and I am joined by two new co-hosts, Andres Mejia and Indy Ofrank.
Hi, I'm Andres, a sophomore at JHU studying international studies and sociology.
Hello, my name is Indy. I'm a freshman at Hopkins, and I'm planning on majoring in international studies. In 2013, Chinese President Xi Jinping unveiled the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive investment project that has since funneled billions of dollars towards building and financing infrastructure projects to connect China to the world. The BRI has been one of the defining foreign policy features of Xi Jinping's presidency. The impact and sustainability of the BRI, as well as its implications for global Chinese influence, have raised foundational questions within the international community. Joining us today to provide some answers to these questions is Dr. Daniel Markey.
Dr. Daniel S. Markey is a senior research professor and director at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, where he teaches courses in international politics and policy. He was a senior fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, having previously held the South Asia portfolio on the Secretary's policy planning staff in the U.S. Department of State. In March 2020, he wrote the book China's Western Horizon, Beijing and the New Geopolitics of Eurasia, the inspiration for our interview. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
All right, well, Professor Markey, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Could you please give our listeners a general overview of China's Belt and Road Initiative? What is it? How did it begin? And what counts as a part of the BRI, whether it's a project or a country?
Sure. The Belt and Road Initiative is now considered to be the signature foreign policy agenda of China's president and leader, Xi Jinping. And it is sort of broadly conceived as a major, in fact, remarkable infrastructure investment initiative globally, with estimates ranging somewhere in the trillion plus dollars likely to be spent by China over some indeterminate time period in the future, perhaps a decade or two, and with two major arms, one extending across continental Eurasia and one throughout maritime Southeast and South Asia. And it has grown from that, this Belt and Road Initiative has grown from those to include even a digital Silk Road, an Arctic Silk Road. All of these things are basically kind of umbrella catch-alls for a more ambitious Chinese foreign policy agenda to work with and in countries in its neighborhood and beyond. And that is a reflection of President Xi Jinping's broader ambition for China to show itself to be a major world power, if not a superpower, in the coming years. All of this is timed in terms of its origins, is in some ways really linked to President Xi Jinping, initiatives that came about after he became president in 2012. So in 2013 through 2015, we begin to see the initial stages of the BRI. And it has also brought together two major Belt and Road forums in Beijing, conclaves that have brought to China's capital leaders from around the world to discuss their different projects and the ways in which they might work with China going forward. So that's a kind of a broad overview. Let me just observe that the Belt and Road Initiative is in some ways more than meets the eye and in some ways less than meets the eye. And then we can take it from there. In terms of being less than meets the eye, it is difficult from official Chinese documents and the public record to tell precisely what counts. I think you asked what's a BRI project and what isn't. It's often quite difficult to discern between projects like, say, a major metro project in Lahore in Pakistan, Orange Line Metro Project, that may or may not be Belt and Road Initiative, but it is certainly a Chinese financed infrastructure project and other projects that seem to be more likely Belt and Road. And then to get to the bottom of how they all add up has proven difficult, actually impossible for the more intrepid bean counters out there. So in some ways, you know, we really don't know what precisely Belt and Road is. And in other ways, Belt and Road should be considered more than meets the eye. And this is a plea that I make to most audiences, not to see China's foreign policy initiatives and agenda in the world today as fully described by infrastructure investment, not to see the Belt and Road initiative and all of its promises kept or unkept as the sum total of what China is doing. In fact, to recognize that in many parts of the world, what China is doing that's not strictly a part of Belt and Road is probably a lot more important than what it is doing as a part of Belt and Road. We shouldn't be distracted or have our eyes pulled in the wrong direction so that we misunderstand really what China is up to.
So for all that the BRI is and isn't, you know, if it's more than meets the eye or less, you know, how important is the BRI for China's foreign policy, for the Xi administration, and why is the Xi administration pursuing the BRI?
Well, it is quite clear that this Belt and Road Initiative has become the signature foreign policy initiative of President Xi Jinping. And President Xi Jinping is the leader without any real dispute in China. So it is the foreign policy initiative of China being even built into its constitution at this point and endorsed in a number of major Communist Party of China documents. So it is officially the, in effect, the law of the land. And so in that respect, it's central, it's important to understanding kind of a broader and new ambition that President Xi brings to China, an ambition that is rooted in many ways in prior decades, that is earlier initiatives to connect China to other economies in its neighborhood and beyond, and to build out from within China. And especially, I've written extensively about China's relations with continental Eurasian states, so states, Eurasian powers to China's west, to firm up those ties. But even beyond that, to link China to other major economies in the world, and to do so by investing in infrastructure, which is sorely needed throughout much of Asia and Eurasia. But the drivers behind this are not strictly a kind of a everybody will do better in the world and China by investing in its neighbors will help them and help itself. This is related in many ways to several dynamics, one being a Chinese effort to take some of its overcapacity in construction infrastructure, that is huge construction companies and steel manufacturers and so on inside of China that have already more or less overbuilt for the demand inside of China, and to send them further afield so that they can continue to do their business, to make money, but to do it outside of China's borders where presumably there's greater demand. Another driver is resource extraction, especially energy resources from China's neighbors, particularly in Central Asia and onward into the Middle East, where China has obviously been a major buyer of oil and gas, and to begin to build out further the pipelines and other means to bring those resources back to China. And then the third driver has been something having to do with the uneven development within China itself. Western China has developed much more slowly, has lagged Eastern China in terms of the poverty of its people. And so China has wanted to redress that. That's been a longstanding problem. Part of what has happened is that Beijing has recognized that in order for parts of Western China to do better, to build themselves up, they need to be better connected to the neighborhood, to the wider neighborhood. And so that requires also beginning to develop ties and to also invest in the development in countries like Pakistan or Kazakhstan or onward into Central Asia and the Middle East and South Asia, all of which are intended in part to contribute to development within China itself. So all of these are drivers. There are also, I would add briefly, security drivers as well, also related to China's concerns about its Western provinces, and in particular, Xinjiang, where you had a significant Uyghur Muslim population, which has not been happy with Beijing's rule and which has had bouts of unrest, disillusionment, and of course, China has cracked down ruthlessly on the Uyghurs of Xinjiang, but has also seen that part of the desire to crack down has been to crack down on extremism, Islamist ideology beyond China's borders, again, in places like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, and so on, to try to staunch the tide of these ideas into China for fear that that population and other Muslims inside of China will bring grief to Beijing. So there's a security motivation as well. And then finally, there's a strategic desire to extend China's influence westward and beyond, and to use economic tools of statecraft to do that. So those are the main drivers as I see them.
So you've been talking about the motivations behind China's various Belt and Road investments. And as you discuss in your book, China's Western Horizon, which was published earlier this year, China's economic, political, and military influence has grown significantly in Eurasia as a part of BRI projects. So generally speaking, how have these BRI projects changed relations between China and other Eurasian countries?
Well, generally speaking, this is a part of a broader story. Again, Belt and Road Initiative, something under President Xi Jinping, but the underlying drivers of economic, the extension of China's economic footprint, so to speak, into many of these countries, you know, date back a couple of decades now, if not further. And what we've seen is that all told, they've brought considerable economic influence, Chinese economic influence, into countries from Kazakhstan, which I look at in my book, to Iran, to Pakistan, to Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere as well, which means that China is often the principal investor, the principal buyer of goods from these countries, often hydrocarbon energy, but not always, the principal seller of retail manufactured items. So it has a huge role to play in the economies of each of these countries. And the Belt and Road Initiative is one piece of that, and is really, as I said earlier, really focused on infrastructure investment. But it shouldn't, again, distract us from the fact that, you know, say China's infrastructure investment in Kazakhstan is important and is growing, and the Belt and Road Initiative is a piece of that, and is something that the government of Kazakhstan at least has been excited about. But China's investment in Kazakhstan's energy infrastructure, oil and gas infrastructure, predates the Belt and Road Initiative and dwarfs it significantly. And that's true in a lot of these countries. So, you know, we should be careful about just confining ourselves to BRI. The real story is that China's economic influence across this region and across the globe has grown tremendously. And that economic influence sometimes carries with it a political influence, sometimes popular, sometimes unpopular, and even at times brings with it a strategic influence, also plays to the advantage or disadvantage of various states. And each state across this region is likely to be different. Different states and different peoples within those states will see their interests differently. So it's a quick example in Pakistan. The Pakistani army has had a long-standing ties to China, sees its interests as keeping those ties close, as building them up, and does not see China as terribly threatening. In fact, sees China as very helpful to Pakistan in its competition and hostilities with India. But there are some in Pakistan, for instance, the people in a number of people in Balochistan, one of its provinces, who see China's investment in their country as threatening their own control over territory and likely to further alienate them from power within their own part of the world. And they see it as something that they're quite worried about, something that will lead to further political repression and undermine their interests in Pakistan. And you can see versions of that story playing out across the region, where some people are likely to be winners, others losers. All are looking to see increasingly to see how China's increasing role is likely to help or harm them. And so the big change is China's presence is growing everywhere, and everybody is looking over their shoulder to see how that affects them.
So you've covered the extent of the Belt and Road Initiative on countries who have accepted it, but how has the BRI affected countries who have abstained or at least resisted? Particularly, I'm asking about how China's Belt and Road Initiative has affected its relations with European countries and the United States.
Well, the United States and European countries actually, in terms of the Belt and Road, started with the degree of openness to the prospect of major new Chinese investments in infrastructure in third countries. They didn't necessarily see that as threatening. In fact, the Obama administration in particular, when looking at what China was saying about what it might do in Pakistan or elsewhere in Central Asia, didn't really see it as necessarily problematic because it recognized that the need for infrastructure investment was quite real, and other investors were not filling those gaps. So it was kind of agnostic at first. Others, though, the Japanese and the Indians in particular, were more skeptical at the outset. They perceived that China's Belt and Road Initiative was likely to threaten their influence. Japan, a longstanding kind of competitor with China, but also a country that's invested billions, probably trillions of dollars in infrastructure throughout Asia over decades, was worried that Chinese investments in the Belt and Road might overshadow what Japan was doing and might also come at a cost because China could be throwing money around into projects that were of lower quality, that might have less environmental protections, and generally would just produce outcomes that were subpar. India also was worried about what China was doing, and especially what China was doing in contested territories in Pakistan and elsewhere to India's north, and saw in what China was doing also similar concerns to the Japanese and voiced those loudly, labor concerns, environmental concerns, and so on. So those critiques started to bubble up, and especially as the later Obama administration and then into the Trump administration started to have broader concerns about what China was doing in the world, started to see China more as a competitor, started to fear that China may turn its Belt and Road Initiative into a broader strategic initiative, took on the criticisms that had been voiced by the Japanese and the Indians. And now I would say that altogether, and including increasingly with the European partners, this critique of the Belt and Road as something that could be threatening, again, environmentally, labor standards, quality of infrastructure, debt issues, and even bring with it a kind of a Trojan horse of Chinese influence. All of these states are now more aligned and have voiced this criticism more publicly. And so now you've get this kind of negative reaction from them, pretty much no matter how China frames the Belt and Road. And I'd say that's about where we stand today.
And you know, you've discussed how BRI investments are not always welcomed totally warmly for several reasons, including economic, political, environmental, strategic. And in fact, the BRI has received international criticism in the last few years for some of its projects in developing countries. China's been accused of using debt trap diplomacy to gain influence over certain developing countries. Could you explain what debt trap diplomacy is and why it has become such a point of major criticism of the BRI?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the kind of the storylines, the narratives that repeats itself again and again is the story of China's investment in Sri Lanka. And in particular, its investment in a port, a Hambantota port. And the idea here is that China came in offering Sri Lanka significant loans. The Sri Lankan government at the time took these on, as it turned out, and probably not surprising to anyone, including the Chinese, Sri Lanka was unable to repay them. China then decided or renegotiated and turned the loans into ultimately a long-term stake in the port infrastructure. And in doing so, translated debt, in this case, Sri Lankan debt, into more or less Chinese ownership over what some people believe could be a strategic port in a country that neighbors India, one of China's competitors. So the broad storyline here is that China is probably going out around the world, dangling debts in front of a variety of smaller countries. These countries, for various reasons, take on the debt. When they can't afford to pay it back, they're trapped. And China does this intentionally to trap them into dependency relationships, almost like a new version of imperial or colonial rule, and forces them to give up something that China really wanted in the first place. So that's the narrative and that's the fear. And this has, you're absolutely right, been a point of criticism from the United States and from other countries around the world. The reality, I think, is a little bit more complicated than that. And I would simply say that a country like Sri Lanka had the option of not taking on this debt. And to better understand what really happened here, you need to look at the politics of, at the time, the Rajapaksa government, which for political reasons wanted to firm up closer ties with China, take on debt, demonstrate for domestic political reasons that it had the support of Beijing and that it had the wherewithal to build out a fantastic new port in the hometown of the then leader of the country. And so this had a profoundly kind of domestic political origin, which probably wasn't, in my view, actually anticipated by Beijing at the outset. So to say that China entered into this agreement at the outset to trap Sri Lanka is probably incorrect. However, China was willing to opportunistically take advantage of these loans and translate them into something ultimately that probably plays to its advantage. And we'll see if that's really true. The basic point I would make, though, is China's economic power, its influence, its capacity to make loans is growing, and other countries are having to make difficult choices about whether entering into arrangements with China will play to their advantage. And some of these countries will make bad choices, and that may or may not play to Beijing's strategic advantage. It also may or may not be the kind of thing that Beijing has planned at the outset. But when these opportunities present themselves, China's in a good place to take advantage and to push forward. So we see similar storylines, I would say, in Pakistan and possibly now in Iran as well, where China is extending its influence, its access, building out new ports. These are maybe strictly not debt trap stories, but they are stories of Chinese strategic opportunism.
You know, we've discussed certainly, you know, very negative reactions from Europe and especially the U.S. towards this alleged debt trap diplomacy by China. You know, however much this is really substantiated, however much this is, you know, really China's true intent or just a result. But have these accusations also affected the trust between developing countries who are often the recipients of these loans and China? You know, are these accusations, you know, really eroding the trust between the recipients and China?
I would say that most countries around the world and populations around the world are now more than, say, 5 years ago, more inclined to ask their leaders more difficult questions about whether doing business with China in these ways actually plays to the advantage of the nation, so to speak. And we've seen a number of other instances where countries, so Malaysia, you had an election, they pushed back on Chinese deals. Even in Pakistan, actually still a close friend and partner to China, you saw a lot of politics surrounding its economic arrangements with China. You've seen criticism in a variety of other countries. So I would say public criticism or skepticism has grown, but the willingness of leaders in many of these countries, and again, many of these countries are not democracies, or they may be weak or fragile democracies, which means that their leaders may still take on closer ties with China because it serves their personal or political ends rather than a broader sense of national ends. So it's a mixed story. I think a lot of countries are still in bed with the Chinese and are likely to stay there. I mean, look at Saudi Arabia, for instance. You know, it's hard to say that the people of Saudi Arabia have much say, or even if they're quite skeptical about closer ties with China. But what their leaders do know is that selling oil to China is practically a requirement and will likely remain so for the next several decades for their economy to have any chance at all. And beyond that seeking Chinese investments in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, including in technology, are things that will probably serve their at least narrow advantages or interests of their leaders. And so they will continue to do so, even if, for instance, China's treatment of Muslims at home becomes increasingly unpopular within a broader segment of the population. So the ability of many of the publics in these societies to really push back despite some of their rising skepticism is often limited. And I think we need to keep that in mind.
So as you've mentioned before, the projects under the BRI have, you know, there's been an investment of over $1 trillion, some estimates have said. So due to the far-reaching nature of these BRI projects, there have been growing concerns about the financial sustainability of China's investments under the BRI. In particular, there have been some reports about, for example, lack of communication between different projects, or in particular, a lack of central control of all BRI projects. So how serious are these concerns about the financial sustainability of the BRI?
Well, I think the world, and especially the United States and our partners and the Japanese and so on, we've learned a lot about smart best practices in infrastructure, major infrastructure development over many decades. I mean, some would say longer than that. You know, we've been doing infrastructure investment since the colonial imperial era around the world. And we've learned a variety of things. And, you know, among them is that you can build infrastructure quickly, or you can build it sustainably. And you can build it cheaply and quickly, or you can build it with a higher quality in mind. You can't really have everything. You can't have cheap, fast, high quality, sustainable. These things don't tend to go together. And governance and institutions and wherewithal or human capacity to manage infrastructure projects after they're built, to maintain them, to run them, depending if it's a port or a power plant or things like that, you need high quality, high functioning institutions to outlast the initial building of these projects. And what we are seeing now in terms of Chinese activities is more of the cheap and fast rather than the long-term sustainable. And so, you know, this is a right criticism, as I mentioned earlier, coming definitely from the Japanese, now increasingly from the Europeans, from the United States, and from countries themselves. I think we all know that these things, that, you know, these are not best practices. However, when you are one of these countries that is lacking in infrastructure, or where the leadership is not democratic, is illiberal, sees its own particular interests as being more important than the interests of the nation, then what China has to offer is still quite attractive. You may be in situations where China is the only state that is offering to build anything in your country or anything significant. And so there your choice is between something and nothing, and usually something wins. So that's the situation we find ourselves in. If the United States and Japan and our other partners were able to beat China on price and speed and look the other way on corruption and quality, we would certainly be able to outdo them in terms of beating back the BRI. But in terms of our long-term interests, that's probably not where we want to be. I think it's important that we maintain sort of an eye on that longer-term agenda, as you put it, sustainability. That will probably be important, and various countries will appreciate that one way or another as time goes by.
So as you mentioned, there are evidently some pitfalls of BRI projects, but have China's investments in BRI projects overall helped or harmed the Chinese economy?
Well, now you're asking about the Chinese economy, and that is extremely difficult to gauge. I think I said at the outset that part of the impulse behind BRI was to export over capacity of Chinese construction materials and other resources, including just to make work for large numbers of Chinese companies that have overbuilt within China itself. It's hard to tell whether that's really working. But it's probably, in a narrow sense, it probably is. In other words, if you can send a major Chinese construction company into one of its neighbors, put it to work there on a BRI project, then you are probably, at least with that make work project, keeping them from going belly up rather than what might happen if they didn't have that work to do. So that's a kind of a way of recycling Chinese resources. You've got state resources that are going into the Belt and Road Initiative in terms of loans, and they are then cycling back into Chinese manufacturing in ways that build out other countries and leave the debt for those countries to be repaid over time. So that's probably working reasonably well. But there are Chinese themselves who are questioning whether BRI is something that is economically beneficial to China. Just like in many other countries, there is some criticism, though it's more muted in China because this is a signature initiative of President Xi Jinping. But there is criticism, and there has been criticism, that maybe China is overspending, that maybe China is giving too much to other countries and not saving as much at home at a time when the Chinese economy appears to be growing less rapidly than it has in the past. The trouble is getting your hands on the numbers, at least good numbers, is quite difficult. There's a lot of politics involved. And because this is something that the highest levels of the Chinese government want to work, that is, they're invested in the BRI politically, they do not want evidence of its economic shortcomings to become widely known at home or abroad. So they have every reason to hide that type of information and to keep the game going. And I imagine that it will continue to go, partly because it's not just an economic story, it's also a strategic story. And there too, you know, as I say, China is looking to demonstrate itself to be a global player, a major power in the world. And this is one piece of that broader agenda. And so even if it costs something, it's probably something that China can bear, and they'll keep going.
I wanted to dive a bit deeper into that. I'm wondering, because there has been, you know, some international speculation that, you know, a lot of these countries cannot make good on their loans to China, and that China is overspending, but also being somewhat reckless in their loaning to these countries. And especially with the onset of the coronavirus, it may be even more difficult for these countries to pay back China. Do you think that there is a threat that, you know, large-scale defaults might happen? And would that play to China's advantage? Because then China could, you know, carry out the debt trap diplomacy that has been described? Or would that really be a threat to the financial viability on China's part of this BRI strategy?
Well, one thing to keep in mind, look, the answer, of course, I mean, it's a great question. And at some level, the answer is unknown. So we're left to speculate. One of the things that is worth keeping in mind is that even at its kind of greatest magnitude, realistic magnitude, the Belt and Road Initiative is something that I think China can afford. China has the capital and the wherewithal. Even if it doesn't call in these loans immediately, if it puts them, say, on a much longer time frame, has the wherewithal to stretch this out. It has a massive economy now, and it's been growing for decades. And so the diversification of its debt risk is not something that I think is impossible for Beijing to withstand. In addition, I think it's important sometimes to recognize that the scale, I mean, this is a related point. The scale of some of these projects, though considerable for the countries involved, isn't all that great if you're measuring it against, say, the scale of a significant developed country. So in Pakistan, one of the cases I know better, the current estimates of what China has invested, somewhere in the magnitude of $20, $25 billion. $20 to $25 billion for Pakistan is a significant investment, especially since it's taken place over only about 5 years. But for China, $20 to $25 billion, though it's important, is you know, is not going to break the bank. This is you know, a relatively sustainable level, and beyond that, China sees its relations with Pakistan in terms of strategic value of Pakistan. And it's as I mentioned before, its hostility toward India as well outweighing that kind of economic sacrifice. So my bet is, you know, and this is replayed elsewhere, China's investment in Pakistan is more considerable than many other countries. I think they'll chalk this up to, that is, Beijing will be able to chalk these loans up to both put them on a longer-term repayment track and also see them through a semi-strategic as well as commercial lens, and be able to wait out the downsides, partly because of the COVID-19 global economic crunch, and partly because some of these loans would never have been repaid in the first place. In other words, bottom line, I think China's economy is big enough and strong enough and will continue to be powerful enough to weather this particular storm. And these countries are going to have to restructure not just these loans, but if you look at their overall loan portfolios, they also typically owe a lot to Western and multilateral donors as well, or banks. So it's not just China that they're having to renegotiate with. And that story of how they deal with China isn't necessarily always the central one in terms of how their economies will play out over time. So so I think this is actually more sustainable. I'm not somebody who thinks this is all built a house of cards that is all going to tumble in on itself because of the scale issue and the relative scale of these projects compared to China's overall economy.
Despite being the subject of much criticism, both internally, as you've mentioned, and externally, of course, you've said that the BRI still remains a cornerstone of President Xi's foreign policy, and that'll probably last far into the future. How do you see these criticisms, though, as potentially, you know, shaping or affecting the implementation or form of the BRI? And would you expect these changes to affect China's global standing?
Well, look, in the difference between the two Belt and Road forums that have taken place in Beijing, you've seen President Xi personally suggest that whereas initially the Belt and Road was a kind of a macro, sweeping, broad agenda, which was pretty ill-defined, and was almost all inclusive in terms of what could be considered Belt and Road. And in the second Belt and Road forum, what you saw was a narrowing of that characterization, a greater specificity, and an effort by, again, President Xi to suggest that now some of the details needed to be sorted out. And in that shift in terms of emphasis, what was effectively happening was a recognition of some of the skepticism, some of the criticism, some of the desire to see China do a better job with Belt and Road projects than it had at the outset. So at first, it was a kind of a free-for-all, a spending frenzy, ill-conceived in many instances, undisciplined, all-encompassing. And then gradually, China has tried to scale back discipline and find ways to better define and characterize and then implement project. So what you might see this, or you might, a way of seeing all of this is China's on a learning curve in taking on a remarkably ambitious, sweeping agenda outside its borders. China was trying to do something new and different, had a lot to learn. And a number of the Chinese experts, scholars that I've talked to have said to me, listen, have some patience. You know, we're 5 years in. We have a lot to learn. We'll get better at this. That criticism, we're taking the criticism on board. We're trying to make sense of it and improve our operating procedures as we go. And I think that some of that is likely to happen. And, you know, the rest of us who are somewhat concerned about China's growing influence and interest globally, we should be careful what we wish for. If they become actually quite good at this, then they'll be less likely to make bad loans, less likely to alienate their neighbors, more likely to extend their influence, build out smart projects, and extend their material and political power beyond their borders. So there is a question there about precisely, say, from the United States, what we'd like to see. But I think there's every reason to think that China will become, you know, more careful as it goes, in part in response to the criticism that has received from other countries. But one last point here. as it goes, it is making both friends and, you might say, adversaries or even enemies. And when it makes mistakes, when China makes mistakes in other countries, people remember. And in some of these countries, they don't have a long or deep history of connections with China. And so they're learning what it's like to work with China. And if they learn lessons at the outset that China is difficult or dangerous or doesn't play to their advantages or rips them off or traps them in debt, these are lessons that are likely to make them more wary of working with China in the future. And so, we'll see how that goes. So far, it's been a mixed bag, but also so far, it's been a relatively short period of time. And I think we need to have a little bit of a more far-sighted view of these developments as they unfold.
And certainly, it's difficult to see exactly how this will shape up, especially in the near or in the long-term future. But certainly, the BRI is an attempt to expand China's influence. But I'm wondering, how will that influence look like, once it has been expanded? Some observers fear that BRI recipient countries will be preferential trading partners to China, and the world may be divided, so to speak, between members of the BRI and China versus other countries who are closer with the West in trading relations. And so I'm wondering, do you think fears along that line are well-founded, or do you think that these Chinese investments in infrastructure globally can improve trade globally by increasing trade capacity? And so there's perhaps less to fear in that regard.
Well, I think here's where it's really important that we not confine our own analysis to infrastructure or to the BRI per se in some narrow sense. We have to look at the whole economic story of China's involvement with various countries or in various countries, as well as its increasing political influence and even military or security influence. Because if we just look at infrastructure, I think there are a lot of cases in which we'd have to say, this is a winning formula and is not terribly threatening, not terribly worrisome, has the potential to benefit both China and the recipient country, and even to build out regional economic integration in places in the world that would really benefit from that, like Central Asia, or even parts of South Asia. So if we just look at the infrastructure, it doesn't look terribly worrisome. But, these are countries that are already trading with China extensively. It's usually their major trading partner. That creates other types of dependencies and asymmetries in terms of power relations. These are countries that will, I think, increasingly see China as, if not the only game in town, they already see it as the most important game in town, and will not want to upset Beijing. And Beijing plays tough. As we've seen a number of instances, again, this is not about infrastructure. This is about trade and about access to markets. And for instance, if you say something dismissive or critical of what China is doing to its own people, and in particular to Uyghurs and Muslims inside of China, you may find yourself on the receiving end of effectively targeted sanctions that will take your business out of China, make it impossible for you to make money in China or working with China. So just exactly how much are you likely to see criticism going forward if you do that sort of thing? Play that out multiple times across different fronts, and you get the problem of China being simply able to throw its weight around to force countries or by their own interests, by their own economic interests, incline them not to say anything critical of China, not to stand up against what China may be doing both internally or with respect to Taiwan or Hong Kong or in other sectors further afield. And then within these countries themselves, to see as their markets are increasingly dominated by Chinese imports, but their infrastructure is also being built out by Chinese companies. And that infrastructure includes telecommunications infrastructure, IT infrastructure, and that gets into the areas of control over the internet, providing their already not terribly democratic or liberal leaders the capacity to repress political opposition, to silence or censor dissent, to use facial recognition technologies and other things to keep track of, to surveil its own people. The implications there go well beyond, you know, who built a bridge or a road or a power plant, and into who controls the media, the education, the mental space of societies. And once you get into that point, then you have to ask whether, say, American ideas or American companies or the U.S. government are competing on a level playing field in these societies, or whether they're effectively being locked out. And that, of course, gets to the point of, you know, does this become something that is threatening to other interests? And to your question, does that create a kind of a Chinese sphere of influence, if not politically in an old-fashioned sense of conquering territories, but in a new age sense of controlling what is said within these countries by way of economic influence and as I said before, technological influence? That's worrisome. That's the kind of thing that really worries people like me and others about the direction that we may be going in a number of these societies. And the one very positive thing I would say is that many of the peoples in these countries are also somewhat worried about this. Maybe not in quite the way that I would like. They're often less concerned about democracy per se or liberal values, but they're often concerned about self-governance, about sovereignty, about being able to run their own affairs without external influence. And if they believe that China intends to influence them in ways that undermine them, I think they'll push back. And that's an area of at least narrow optimism that I have across this region.
As we've covered, China has certainly been making strides towards becoming a preeminent power, not only in Eurasia, but globally. And the United States, with regards to this and the Belt and Road Initiative, has certainly been a chief critic. I was wondering how the United States could or even should respond to China's growth.
Well, the U.S. reaction to China is likely, has been, I think, during the Trump administration, and even if we see a Biden administration next, is likely to be, as I would say, the ordering principle of U.S. foreign policy. That is how we compete with and in some ways cooperate with Beijing will shape our agenda, not just with respect to response on something like BRI or infrastructure, but in just about every aspect of how we deal with the world. So you want to talk about climate change, how we negotiate with China will be at the center of that. You want to talk about our alliance relationships, increasingly our relations with Europe, traditional Western European partners and NATO and so on. We will be talking with them about how do we manage our relations with China as much or more than anything else. In the past, it might have been Afghanistan or then Russia, and now increasingly it will be China. So, you know, this is the question: how are we going to manage and respond to China? And it's not just a matter of, you know, do we build up a U.S. equivalent to the Belt and Road, or find ways to throw investment at infrastructure in Asia to compete with the Chinese, but it's really every aspect of what we do. And for my money, that all really has to begin, you know, the framing principles of that have to begin with the United States returning to a more traditional place of attempting to lead a wider body of allies and friends and partners in the world. And in doing so, to leverage those positive relationships, which I think can be built and rebuilt, into points of sometimes coercive and sometimes attractive power in dealing with China, so that we don't end up in situations where China is setting the rules or standards in third countries and we have nothing else to offer, because we're working with our allies and partners and we have lots of alternatives to offer, say in terms of telecommunications technologies that can compete with Huawei and 5G coming out of China. or other standards and technologies, or even coming back to infrastructure investment, we can partner more effectively with our Japanese friends and others to offer longer term and more sustainable, attractive options for these countries, all the while also committing ourselves to principles that I think ought to, over the long time, also be attractive. That is, principles of human rights, of liberal values, of democracy, of freedom for peoples to make their own choices. These are the kinds of things that I think ultimately will make us more effective in a global competition with China, rather than going our own way or attempting to one-up them or copy them or see what they are doing as something that we have to respond to. We should reassert a more traditional position of global leadership. And that will be very difficult for China to compete against, I think.
Well, Professor Markey, thank you so much for this, you know, in-depth and expansive explanation of this major topic in international affairs. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course, it was my pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and to the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.